You're listening to CPA Review, and more you're listening to CPA Review, and more you're listening to CPA Review, and more you're listening to CPA Review, and more.
You're listening to another episode of CPA Review and More with your host, Phil Yeager of Yeager CPA Review. And my name's Rob Medford. I'm your producer and director here at CPA Review and More and Yeager CPA Review. And together, we're bringing you the number one podcast for CPAs. If you're in the market for a CPA Review course or simply want to know more information about the CPA exam, check out the Yeager CPA Review website at YeagerCPAReview.com. You'll also see that we've released a new subscription format of the same great Yeager CPA Review course that you know and love on a new month-to-month, no-commitment format. For more information on that, once again, check out the Yeager website at the link in the description field of this show. Without any further delay, I'm going to pass the microphone over to Phil.
Hi, Rob. How you doing this morning? Rob is there, and I can actually see him. Most of you can't. If you can't see him, then something is wrong with your computer. But anyway, today, we have had such shows in the past weeks that I think to myself, can we do it any better than we've done the last few weeks? It's hard to top off quality. But today, all right, I have as my guest a friend, and he's a friend of my family, and we met Steve on a cruise ship. Is that right, Steve? Steve Gross?
On the Disney cruise, yes.
We're on a Disney cruise, and yes, that was the cruise where it was 7 days, 8 nights, or 8 nights, 7 days. But anyway, I got sick for most of the days because I was around these kids, all right? And I was in the room for, I don't know if that was the 5 or 7 days that I was in the room sick. So therefore, I do recommend to the public Disney cruises. Excellent, right? Except bring many surgical masks with you to avoid getting these diseases from these children. But I do love kids. So anyway, Steve is a CFP, a Certified Financial Planner. He's a chartered financial consultant. And he does financial planning you're in the Westchester, New York area, right, Steve?
That is correct.
And Steve, let me show you how intelligent he is, because I never made it to this school. He graduated the University of Pennsylvania, all right, in beautiful downtown Philly. Is that where you were?
Yes, we were.
And he studied, because he was in the city, he studied urban studies. So Steve is an authority on cities. No, I'm just kidding. So anyway, we're going to have Steve discuss today because financial planning is really, really important. And I guess I would ask you, Steve, at what age should someone start doing financial planning?
You know, I think the best time to start is when you start being responsible for your own finances. You know, I think it's a great time when you're too many times people start thinking about this once they're making money and they're in their 30s, and they've usually already missed a decade where they can start building good habits. So I would say, you know, really right out of college.
So let's define what is financial planning. In fact, you have the CFP, Certified Financial Planner. Obviously, you took an exam and you're now a financial planner. So, all right. Can you give in 25 words or less, we'll let you go to 26, but 25 words or less, can you discuss with me and tell me what is financial planning?
I never counted the words, but I will try. Helping people understand what their goals are and helping them put a plan in place systematically to achieve those goals.
Now, Steve, did you read that or did you memorize that?
I just made that up.
Yes, that was very good, Steve. And it fooled
me. And I think it was 25 words or less.
It was. Oh, good. Did you count that, Rob? I think it was. I counted 16. But anyway, Steve, you know, I did have the CFP designation. I took that exam, but unfortunately I had to give it up because of the continuing education that they required. And then you had the CPA continuing ed, and I never had any time to spend with my family. So anyway, I gave up the CFP, and It was actually, it's interesting. I was actually had an accounting practice at the time in Denver, Colorado. That's not the interesting part. But, you know, people would come in and I would do tax planning. You know, they wanted to know what's going on with my taxes. What could I do so I don't have this tax liability next year? And I said to myself, well, that's great. I do this type of thing. It's, you know, it's a financial planning. All right. So they would always ask me this, are you a certified financial planner? And I would say, no. So after being asked that so many times, I decided to go take the test. Now, what are the areas that make up financial planning? Is taxation, I mean, what'd you say, tax planning? Would that be one of the concepts of financial planning? And do you do that?
It would, and we do, but we're not CPAs, so we don't prepare returns. We don't, we always tell clients that you need to do a little bit of thoughtful planning looking ahead, but they should always check with their CPA before they take any of our advice. But yeah, we get involved in that area. But the other areas are looking at your financial situation, which might mean your cash flow, your net worth, protection issues, you know, like life insurance, disability coverage, even as you get older, things like long-term care, planning for other goals. Sometimes it might be sending kids to college, or even if you want to buy your first home, retirement planning. You know, a lot of people have a retirement account through work and making sure you're saving enough in the right ways. Tax planning, as we just talked about, and looking for opportunities, especially there have been a lot of changes the last year or two to help people understand how to manage that. And then you've got estate planning, you know, protecting what you've already built up as a nest egg.
With the increase in the state exemption amount, right, do you still have a lot of people having estate tax problems?
In some ways, yeah, but it's actually different than what you might think, because I'll give you an example. In the state of Pennsylvania, for example, Pennsylvania has something called, they don't have an estate tax per se, they have an inheritance tax. And the inheritance tax is 4.5% of your net worth or your estate rather, from dollar one. There is no exemption. So, you know, you might have a $10 million estate in the state of Pennsylvania, and you would pay zero federal taxes, but that might mean a $450,000 Pennsylvania inheritance tax. So I think that the liability could still be there, but not what you might expect.
Is that common for there to be a state like you have Pennsylvania? Is that a common thing to have the states tax estates?
It is common, but every state does it differently. So, for example, in New York, there is an exemption, like the federal government has an exemption, and New York has been trying to get their exemption to be in line with the federal exemption level. So in New York, generally speaking, you know, there for most people, there isn't much of an issue. But in some other states, like I mentioned, Pennsylvania, there is no exemption. So it's a problem. So, and then there are other states that have zero estate taxes.
Now, I used to do estate returns many moons ago, and Maryland, where I am, did have a Maryland estate tax, and they called it an inheritance tax also.
Okay.
All right. But when it comes to financial planning, I don't know where I heard this. People, when they reach retirement, they haven't saved enough. And all of a sudden, they wake up and say, we got to start saving. We're retiring pretty soon. Do you find that common, that people don't have enough savings to retire when they want to retire?
I think most people don't, because most people don't do any planning. You know, they have no idea where they are. And a lot of people start late and they figure, you know what, screw it. I'm never going to be able to retire. So I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing without any idea as to if what they're doing is enough or on the right track. And you know what? Very often, it's not about having more money over the years, but just making better choices.
Yeah, because you know, the average individual, they have a savings. I think it's under $500. Is that correct? Or something like that. It's amazingly low. And you know, in case there is an emergency or something, I mean, what are they going to go to? They don't have any emergency fund. I don't remember what the exact amount was, but it was extremely low. And I don't know why people don't think ahead and think and say, gee, I don't care if I'm 25, If I have $500 in my savings account, what am I going to do if I don't have a disability policy and I get sick? You know, it's a very small amount. Do you have clients that do have a substantial amount of savings and are they're prepared for emergencies? Or do you have a number of clients who do not save and just say, oh, I'm never going to be sick, all right? Is your how is your clients based? Is that broad-based as far as your clients? Are they people who think the way of having savings and of savings versus those who just, you know, live from paycheck to paycheck?
You know what it is that we have a little bit of both. I think we have more clients of people who do have savings. But, you know, I think of it this way, is that the reason why people come to see me is because they're motivated to do better, right? And, you know, you could have a million, you could have $10 million, and if you have no motivation, then you're not going to seek advice. So the bottom line is that people who do have motivation tend to have done certain things, whether they did them the right way or not, that's a different story, but that's what tends to motivate people. And those that have inadequate savings have probably put their head in the sand and pleaded ignorance. And so those people, unless something dramatic happens, tend not to do anything until last minute. And then there's only so much we can do.
Now, let's discuss wills if we can. All right. When do you, obviously you don't draw up wills. You said that to an attorney. Is that correct?
Correct.
When does the average person start needing a will?
You know, I think one of the best times is either as you start accumulating assets and or once you start having kids. Because, you know, one of the most important things is when you have kids is to establish guardianship for those children. Because if you don't have that established and something happens to you, there's a problem. And so I think that's really a critical point to really consider start getting wills. Or if you were a good saver earlier on before you had children and you have a decent amount saved, especially non-retirement accounts, because retirement accounts all are required to have beneficiary listings. And when you have a beneficiary listing, that means that that account automatically goes to your beneficiary and it circumvents your will. So you don't need to have a will for those assets. But if you have other assets outside of a retirement account, those would go through probate if you don't, and if you don't have a will, that causes issues.
Discuss probate. What is probate? Most people don't know what probate is.
It's probate, pretty simply, is the process by which your will is goes through the court system to follow the instructions that are in that to distribute your assets. If you don't have a will, then it gets messy, and then there's additional cost. And they have to go by next of kin and things like that to determine who gets what, but things may not play out the way you want them to. So that's why you have a will. But the reality is if you organize your assets where you have beneficiary listings on most of your assets, and if you don't, you can sometimes put a trust in place to facilitate distribution of your assets. But probate is that process of, you know, once you've passed, you know, deciding what goes where.
And without actually a will, a lot of times, and correct me if I'm wrong, your children, without a will, if you die, let's say your husband and wife dies and they don't have a will, all right, the children can go to the state where you live, correct? They may end up going into child care someplace. So isn't that also a benefit of a will? Where the children are going to go should the parents die or something?
Well, that's why you appoint a guardian. You have guardianship spelled out within a will. It's not a will per se. It's the guardianship which is defined within your will. Because if you don't have that, then what happens? It goes by next of kin. So, you know, say, you know, you and your spouse have you each have a sibling, right? And you know, you say, you know what? No way in hell am I going to give my money to my, you know, my kids. Control to my brother, but I don't mind having them go to my wife's sister or something. And then, you know, what happens is if both of you pass away, the court may arbitrarily determine who is the second person to die. And based on the second person to die, they would look at the next of kin. So if they said I was the second person to die, they would go to my brother as the next of kin to say that that person has the first right of refusal to be guardianship, have guard, be be a guardian for the kids. And very often that may or may not be the way you want it to happen. So that's why you appoint a guardian in your will.
And what I was asking, and now let me get my words straight this time. If you die without a will, you're going to have people, maybe relatives, who are going to end up getting money from the estate who would normally not have gotten the money had there been a will. Isn't that correct?
Correct. Yeah, because the state decides who gets what. And again, it may or may not be based upon what you want to see happen.
And those who die without a will, the terminology, I believe, is they die intestate. Is that correct?
Yes. Correct.
All right. Now, here I am. The first thing I'm doing is I get married and I decide to buy a house. And I think to myself, you know, I have two children here and I need to set up an education fund for them in some way. I want them to have money, all right, so that when they finally do graduate high school, if they decide to go on to college, all right, there'll be sufficient money, all right? Now, who sets up those educational funds like that? And who funds them? And how do you fund them?
Wow, that's a loaded question. Actually, that's three questions.
All right, let me ask one then.
So, the best tool right now to save for college or of higher education for kids is called a 529 plan. And a 529 savings plan is a plan where you can put money in. In some states, you actually get a deduction for contributions to the 529, and every state is different. And then that money grows tax deferred. And then if it comes out for college, comes out tax free. So that's kind of a home run. And you know, obviously the parents set it up. Yeah, they can even have grandparents set it up if they choose to, where the child is not the owner, the child is actually the beneficiary. And what happens too is say they get a scholarship or a grant, they don't even use the money. You can actually then change the beneficiary to another child. Let that child keep it and then they could use it for their children someday. So there are lots of different options.
But it has to be used in the future. If the child ends up getting a football scholarship, doesn't use the money, right? The money can go back to that child, but the child can only use it later on for another relative as long as it's for education purposes, right? They can't take it out for non-education purposes.
They can, but then they're going to pay taxes on the growth and there's an IRS penalty. But yes, they can take it out, but to avoid the taxes and the penalty, then you would want to preserve it for some sort of higher education.
Okay. Can they take the money out of the education IRA for any reasons other than education without paying a penalty on the earnings?
Well, it's education IRA is something different. It used to be called a Coverdell IRA. But,
is that still in effect, the Coverdell IRA?
I don't believe so. I think that you can no longer fund those. And the cap was pretty limited in terms of how much you could put in. It was something like $2,000 or $2,500 a year. But as far as 529 accounts, you can take it out if it's not for education, but then there is the penalties that the owner would have to pay or potential taxes.
What happens if you still have money in that Coverdell education IRA and the IRA is not around anymore? They don't have it anymore. You can't fund it. What can you do with the money that's in the old Coverdell or education IRA? What can you do with that money? If you don't need it immediately for education, can you roll it over someplace?
It's a great question. I would have to check into that. I would assume you might be able to roll it over to a traditional IRA. I would have to double check on that. But sometimes too, you can have access to some of these accounts if there's a disability or some sort of other mitigating circumstance. Because I know that was your original question, but the idea is it's not that you can always have access to the money. It's just a function of whether or not there's going to be any tax implication or any IRS penalties. So the idea becomes is that again, if there's a disability or in certain circumstances, if you do get a scholarship, there are situations where you can actually take out some of the money without, yes, there may be taxes, but without IRS penalty.
Now, if I end up, let's go back to my scenario. I buy the house. I have two children And now the concern is this. I want to make sure should anything happen to me, all right, I'm going to take out life insurance. Now, when does an individual put a life insurance policy in a trust? And why would they do that? Is that within your expertise?
Yes. There's two issues. There's purchasing life insurance and then who owns it, right? So the reality is that typically you buy life insurance for a couple of reasons, to pay off debts that you may have. So if you buy a house and you take out a $500,000 mortgage, it's there to potentially pay off that liability. Second is if you have any future goals, like sending a child to college, you could argue that the present day value of sending someone to college is probably about $250,000. So that means that you might want to have, you know, if something were to happen to you, you'd want to be able to fund an education for that child. And third is to provide supplemental income to the surviving spouse if you're no longer around. So those are the three reasons why you own life insurance. The caveat becomes is that life insurance does pay out income tax free to the beneficiary, but it's inclusive in your estate. So depending on the size of your estate, then you may or may not decide whether you should just own it, or you could have a separate entity in what you're calling is what's called an irrevocable life insurance trust, or an ILIT, to own the life insurance policy, so that you could still receive the proceeds tax free, but the value of it would not be inclusive in your estate. And I think for people starting out, it's probably not a concern. Once you start doing more complex estate planning, then at that time, that could be, depending on the value of your estate, could be something to consider.
So if I live in New York, I'm sorry, where did you say, you said there was a state tax in New York or Pennsylvania?
There's a state estate tax in New York. In Pennsylvania, they call it the inheritance tax.
Okay. So anyway, let's assume that I live in Pennsylvania and I take out a $1 million life insurance policy. And I am the owner of the policy. I'm the owner of the policy. Now, I die in a state, let's take Pennsylvania, all right? Is that $1 million? It's a few issues there. I guess the $1 million is not taxable to my gross estate. Is that correct?
The $1 million is, first of all, it depends who the beneficiary is. So if the beneficiary is your wife or your spouse, then anything that you have goes to your spouse without any income tax or estate tax considerations. It's called
the
unlimited marital deduction.
Tax, that's the marital deduction. All right.
That's
but let's
the marital
forget about
deduction.
The final estate tax return. Okay. All right. If I take $1 million policy out and I were to die and I own the policy. Okay. All right. Then what happens is, that when I die, if I own the policy, what will happen to the $1 million proceeds? It'll go into my what? Gross estate, will it not?
It'll go into your gross estate, especially if the beneficiary is your spouse, yes.
Right, but because of the unlimited marital deduction, I will be able to deduct all that out from federal estate tax, correct?
There will be no federal estate tax due.
But will there still be New York state tax?
Well, we were talking about Pennsylvania, but
I'm sorry, Pennsylvania.
That's okay. If the beneficiary is your spouse, there will not be a Pennsylvania inheritance tax. If the beneficiary is somebody that's not your spouse, then there could be, yes.
So basically, Pennsylvania follows the same rules as feds on that.
Yes.
All right. Now, going back to that life insurance trust, all right, with a life insurance policy, all right, are you setting up a trust for a life insurance policy, all right, to protect it against creditors? Why are you setting up a life insurance policy into an irrevocable trust?
It's generally to avoid it being included in your gross estate. I don't think the concern as much as for being, depends on what you do, right? If you're in a high risk business and you want to make sure that that is protected from creditors, then like you say, you own your own business or you're, you know, a doctor or an attorney or somebody where you're always at risk for being sued and you want to protect any assets that you have, then owning it in a trust would do that But generally speaking, I think the predominant reason that you would do it is to not have, you know, it becomes counterproductive. If it's in, say you had a $10 million estate, and now it gets added to the value of your estate to the point where it's now going to become taxable. That in a lot of states, you know, those tax rates are pretty exorbitant. So yes, you get it income tax free, but if it's included in the state estate tax calculation, that's a problem. So that's where you have a trust to own the policy.
When you put a life insurance policy into an irrevocable trust, okay, all right, let's assume I put it into an irrevocable trust. I took out $1 million life insurance policy, put it into an irrevocable trust, right? And it's only been in there for 2 years, All right. My wife was the owner of the policy, and now my wife dies. All right. If there's a $2 million life insurance policy, my wife owns it, and my wife dies, all right, will that life insurance policy be taxable to the estate?
Now, who's the beneficiary?
The beneficiary is the children.
Okay, so then it would. It depends on the premiums. Well, you're now asking a trick question, because what's taxable or what could be brought back into the estate is what was paid for the policy, right? Because you're in a lot of places there's a 5-year look back in terms of funding trusts. However, say the policy premium was $14,000 a year. Right now, the government allows you to give $15,000 per person per year as a gift without any gift tax issues. So if the policy premium was $14,000, that qualifies as that gift that would not be able to be clawed back. But
doesn't life insurance have to be in a trust for at least 3 years to keep it out of the estate?
That I'm not that I know of, but
that 3-year contemplation and death. You've heard the term contemplation and death. That's why I'm wondering if that was still around. But
it's good. Not that I've heard, but that's a good question. I would want to double check on that.
Okay. Now you talked about irrevocable and revocable trusts. Obviously an irrevocable trust cannot be revoked by the grantor, the person setting up the trust, right?
Correct.
Right. But a revocable trust, the grantor, the person setting up the trust, can revoke it. Is that correct? Revocable trust?
Yes, it can be.
Now, if you set up a revocable trust and the trust has land in it and the grantor dies, what will happen to that land if it's a revocable trust? All right. Will it be part of your estate?
Yes, of course.
Okay.
You know, a revocable trust is just a flow through. So it's always still part of your estate. It has nothing to do with taking something out of your estate or not. It's just administration of that asset.
But if you set up an irrevocable trust with that land in there, and then that person dies, the land would not go into your estate. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right. Now, all these fancy things, these trusts, all right, do you recommend to the taxpayer that they go and visit an estate person who knows more about this than they do? But a lot of people don't want to go to an estate tax attorney because the fees are very high. All right. I would think, because, you know, if I don't have the expertise for estate, gift taxes, et cetera, then I would go to an estate tax attorney. All right. Is that what you recommend?
I would always recommend going to an estate attorney to get their opinion on what you should or shouldn't do. But I do throw this out there that a lot of attorneys use trusts as a profit center. So you got to be careful, because very often there are ways to protect your assets just by making sure you have a beneficiary assigned to an account or having a power of attorney on that account, that you can accomplish a lot of the same things without it necessarily having a trust. So it really depends on the ownership, the level of assets, and what your objectives are, whether it's necessary.
Go back to that income. You said estate attorneys set up trusts for income purposes. Is that what you just said?
I've seen a lot of estate attorneys recommend trusts to people as a profit center for their business, when in a lot of cases, it isn't necessary for the client. So, Now, some cases it's obviously appropriate, but I think that depending on this, you know, if somebody has, for example, 95% of their assets are in retirement accounts that are all driven by beneficiary, is there really a need to have a revocable trust? Maybe not. You know, you might just simply be able to accomplish other assets by having a power of attorney and a beneficiary listing put on those other accounts. So I just be careful, because it's not a panacea. It's not for everybody. And there are costs to set up. And then the other piece is, if you do an irrevocable trust, then there's a tax cost every year, because those accounts have to have their own tax ID number and file their own return. With a revocable trust, not necessarily the case. So it's a little simpler.
If you have certain property, you know, you can hold property, joint tenancy, tenancy by the entirety, tenancy in common, okay?
Correct.
Now, if you hold a piece of land, all right, with your wife, your spouse, and it's deeded as tenancy by the entirety, which is joint tenancy between husband and wife, all right? If the husband dies, all right, it's going to go on to the wife, right?
Correct, yes.
Now, will that have to go through probate?
If it's tenancy in entirety, I don't believe so, but I would want to double check. Joint with right of survivorship, absolutely, it avoids probate. Tenants in entirety, because what happens
by
is
the entirety is joint tenancy with husband and wife.
Okay, so then they would not need to go through probate.
Yeah, and actually, when I learned, and correct me if I'm wrong, when I learned this, what the definition of probate was, the purpose of probate is to establish the validity of the will, all right? And that's where there aren't people who survive. Like, for example, if you didn't have tenancy by the entirety and the land was held as tenants in common and one of the tenants dies, all right, his interest in that property would go on to his heirs, correct? Now,
correct.
Would that avoid probate? If it's, you say it's going to go on to my uncle, aunt, all right? If you mention who the beneficiary is, does that tenants in common avoid the probate costs?
No, because the court has to follow the directions of the will to determine where it goes. So I would assume that it's still part of that probate process.
So if you name as tenant in common, if you name that, your interest is going to go on to your Uncle Bill, okay? That still has to go into probate?
Yeah, because there's no beneficiary listing, and okay. And they would go through the will to see what instructions are there to determine, you know, where that asset would go. So now if you had that account or you had that piece of property in because they're also going to, you know, ultimately you're going to also have to change the deed on that property, right? So that's going to have to be determined through that probate process. But, you know, I'm not debating your definition of probate. I try to keep it simple. I just try to say, you know what, it's the process by which the court determines the distribution of your assets based upon what you're, as you said, the validity of your will. You know, what the will instructs you to do as far as who has authority, who's the executor, who are the heirs, what any specific instructions are.
So if my uncle was the co-owner of that land, then what would happen is if I died because the uncle is the co-owner, does that stay out of probate?
Good question. I would assume that it's still probated. I mean, it still will go to him, but, you know, that's the court will follow, you know, the ownership of that asset, but there's no beneficiary listed, you know, other than the joint ownership.
There's no beneficiary listed. If I had the land, if I stated in my will that the land would go to my uncle, then that stays out of probate, correct?
No, because the process of following the instructions in your will is part of the probate process.
All right. So how would I keep that land that I had co-ownership with my uncle to keep it out of probate. Is there any way of doing that?
Well, you could establish a revocable trust to own the property, and the revocable trust could then instruct that at your demise, it goes to your uncle.
So basically, with this discussion, I'm realizing that this whole process of estate taxes could be quite complicated. And don't be, you know, don't be cheap about this. Find a good estate attorney and let them take care of the final wrap-up of the estate, all right? So that you determine who owns what at the time of death and what type of estate tax the assets will be subject to. And that's why they set up all these trusts and everything. And there are so many of them. It's sort of a, would you say estate tax is the hardest part of taxation to the average person?
I don't know if I'd say it's the hardest. It's one of the least understood. So maybe in that regard, yes. I think that there are a lot of moving pieces. The other thing too is don't forget, and I see this all the time, I see clients who go to an attorney, the attorney sets up trusts, and then what happens is none of the assets are ever retitled in the name of the trust. And so what happens is that you think you're all good to go, and then you never retitled it, whether it's an investment account or a property in the name of the trust, and then by not doing that, it did you no good. So you need to make sure that whatever you established, that's only half the equation. The other half is retitling the asset in the name of that trust.
If you don't retitle the assets, what happens?
Nothing. It's as if you never did it.
Okay. And would that be the negligence of the attorney if they failed to do that?
I couldn't tell you legally, but I would say from a an advice perspective, I would hold the attorney responsible for, you know, not following through and making sure that the client is, you know, making sure that the assets are retitled.
So that basically leads me to this. All right, how do you find a good estate tax attorney? I mean, are they're not all good. There's some real bad ones out there. Do you have a group of tax attorneys, estate attorneys that you work with that you do recommend your clients to? Or do you just say to them, go and look it up, find one yourself? All right. What do you do with estate attorneys? How do you deal with that?
I think word of mouth and referral is always the best way of doing it. The caveat is it also, you want to find someone in the state in which you reside, right? So I may not have good estate attorneys in every single state out there. In some states I do have, for example, I know you're in Maryland. I do have someone in Maryland that I use, but in certain states, I don't know anyone necessarily, but that's when you go through that referral chain to try to find somebody through the people that you know who are highly regarded. But that's the best way to find
someone. You know, what happens if you don't know someone? What happens if I don't? How many people know estate attorneys? I mean, only one.
Well, then you ask your accountant who they know, or you ask the person who closed on your house, who's an attorney. You know, who does he or she know who does estate law? So you have to ask around to find, you know, people, and they're out there. It's just you're better off going through that channel than just going on Yelp or something like that to find somebody, because you never know what you're going to get.
All right. So let's go back to my example with the guy with the two kids. All right. And he takes out the life insurance policy. Now, he thinks ahead and he says, you know, I want these two kids to go to the Lackawanna School of Accountancy and Cosmetology. Okay. You ever heard of that school?
Absolutely. Leading in the class.
Yeah. If you don't make it in accountancy, you can actually become a cosmetologist. So anyway, your daughter says, yeah, I really would like to go to the Lackawanna School of Accountancy and Cosmetology. Can you set up something to make sure I have the money there? That's the time you start setting up the 529 plans?
Well, once your kids are born, if not sometimes even sooner, you start. You don't wait till you know where they want to go to school, because at that point, it's usually, I won't say it's too late, but you may have missed out on 10 or 15 years of savings to get you to that point. So as early as you can, because, you know, one thing that you have on your side is time. The more time you have, the less pressure there is to save on a monthly or an annual basis. So you really want to start as early as you can.
Does the 529 plan cover vocational school as well as
yes.
University?
Yes.
It does.
Yes.
Okay. And there's no limit how many years you can take out that money to pay for the education? All right.
As long until it's used up.
Until it's used up. Okay. All right. Well, then the child decides, you know, after about 10 years, that they don't want to go off to college and they want to start investing in llamas. Okay. A llama farm. Is that the name of that animal? Paca.
Yes.
Paca. All right. Paca farm. All right. So the kid says, you know, Dad, I really want to go into alpaca investing. All right. Can I take that money out from my education IRA and buy 12 alpacas? All right. So I can raise alpacas, not alpacas, alpaca. All right. Can you use those?
Is that
funds?
A Wisconsin joke?
A Wisconsin joke? No, I don't. All right. But we'll get to that
alpacas.
One. Soon. We'll ask Alexa. They know every joke. She knows every joke. Anyway. So the daughter goes into the alpaca business, you know, I mean, she just, and now she's in seventh heaven, but she used the money from the education IRA, or I take that back. I like that education IRA, even though it's not in effect. She used the money from the 529 plan to pay for the setting up of that alpaca ranch. All right. Can she take that money out tax-free?
Nope.
All right. So she'll be hit with regular federal taxes, regular state of whatever she lives.
On the growth, not on what she put into it, on the growth.
Yeah, it's on the earnings, right? Is that what you're saying?
Correct, yes.
All right, she can't get it on the growth, on the actual contributions, because the contributions normally are not deductible on your federal return. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Are they coming, so that money can just sit there, that money from the 529? And what happens if my daughter never has children, right? What will happen to that money?
Well, again, you can use it for yourself if you want to go take some classes when you're, retired. But my dad did that. And you want to audit some, you know, take some classes. If you want to gift it to your grandchildren and let them use it, you can do that. But
you can
if you're not
the money to your grandchildren.
You change the beneficiary to your grandchildren.
But does it have to be for education purposes if you gift it to them?
To avoid the taxes, they would need to use it for education.
Okay.
But think of it this way. Even if you paid the taxes, how many years of deferred growth have you had? You might have had 20 years plus of deferred growth. So the tax benefit over the years would offset even if you had to pay some taxes on the back end. But if you don't have to pay taxes, obviously it's that much more favorable.
On 529 plans, all right, should you be as cognizant of what you're investing in? Just like if you invested your own personal portfolio, a lot of people say, oh, that's for education purposes. I'm not going to worry about what the money is invested in. All right. But I am concerned about my regular investment portfolio because that's the money I'm going to live on at retirement. All right. I would think that's not a smart view. You should watch that as closely as you do your regular portfolio. Do you agree?
If anything, more, because think about it. Education comes up a lot sooner than retirement, right? So you have a shorter time window for that money to be invested. So you need to be a little more cognizant of how you're managing that money. One, because you don't want to take on any hits. And two, because you need to use that sooner than, you know, your retirement might be 30 or 40 years off. Education might be 15 years off. So therefore, it's a shorter window. And retirement also, there's flexibility, right? If you're planning for retirement and you go through a recession, you're like, you know what, I'm going to defer retirement 2, 3, 4 years until my investments pop back. You can do that. And it's not like you're going to say, well, I'm going to avoid sending the kid to college for 4 years until the market pops back. That's not going to happen. So it's pretty critical that you're on top of it. And also, and a lot of 529 accounts have, you know, portfolios of mutual funds that you can choose from. And generally, as the child gets closer to college, you want to get more conservative with how you invest it. So you're taking on less risk. So there's less risk of loss.
And when you start dealing with a client, isn't one of the questions they ask their risk tolerance?
Absolutely.
Is that required by the SEC? Who requires that? I'm just curious.
It's either the SEC and or FINRA. Yes. It's what's called suitability. You have to know your client, and you need to understand not just what their risk level is, but investment experience and time frame to their goals and all that stuff.
What determines high risk versus being more conservative? All right. I mean, how do you determine? I tell you, I like to be very high risk. I'm a very risky person. All right. Versus another person says, wait, I'm conservative. All right. What type of investment, if you're a high risk, do you put people into?
Well, high risk generally means one, you have more exposure to the stock market than the bond market or other fixed products. And then within the stock market, you know, you've got, you know, the bigger blue chip companies are obviously less risky than the IPOs and the new, you know, the new stocks, which are much less established and have a much smaller, you know, market cap. So you're taking on greater risk, or even going overseas and buying international positions takes on greater risk because you have other risks that are associated with that.
Do you still put any of your clients into CDs, even though the rates are extremely low?
Depends what the money's for.
All right. When would you put it into a CD versus something like a mutual fund, municipal bond fund, mutual fund, which might pay what, 4%?
Okay. Well, 3.5-4%. The only reason I would do CDs right now is generally say you got, you know, a big payout from your company and you're sitting on $500,000, but you know you're going to have to pay 30% on that in taxes next April. So, you know, we could take 30% of it instead of sitting in a checking account earning 0.25%. You could put it in a CD that you know comes due March 15th or March 30th, so the money is available to you for when you need to pay the taxes on it. But other than that, to get, you know, money market right now pays around 2.5%. So to get a CD that pays more than 2.5%, you got to go out at least probably 2, 3, 4 years. It doesn't really pay. So you're better off either in money market or going to bonds, like municipal bonds is a good place.
How do you determine at what time you invest in bonds versus invest in stock? What determines that?
Well, it depends on, you know, all this surrounds what we call asset allocation, which is your mix of investments. And obviously the younger you are, the more you can have in stocks versus bonds. And the older you are, the less you may want to have in stocks versus bonds. But you also got to kind of marry that with the market environment, right? And the economic environment. You know, right now, you know, there's been a lot of, you know, drama in the markets, and very likely it appears that we may, you know, probably go into recession within the next 1, 2, 3 years. So knowing that, making sure that you're being not taking on too much risk right now because things could get a little bit choppy.
So if there's going to be a recession in 2 years, all right, what should I invest in now? What do you recommend?
Well, you know what? I think you need to own high dividend paying stocks. I think are always very good. But I think bonds are pretty good too.
Stocks or mutual funds?
Well, you got to separate the two. A mutual fund is a portfolio of something. You could have a stock mutual fund or you could have a bond mutual fund. So a mutual fund just allows you to have instant diversification with one ticket. A stock, you're just buying one company. So, if you don't have a lot of experience or you don't have a lot of resources, mutual fund or an index fund is always the way to go. If you're a high roller and you want to take on more risk and you already have a bunch of stocks, then by owning a lot of stocks, you in essence create your own mutual fund based upon the mix of stocks that you already own. So it's really a function of your existing portfolio and your willingness to take on risk.
When it comes to mutual funds, all right, do you think it's, I mean, a lot of people say, well, I don't want to pay that commission every time the broker sells it and buys it, whatever. All right. So I'm going to buy a mutual fund. All right. And I'm going to diversify that mutual fund into stocks. And I'm not going to buy, oh, another thing is, I'm going to actually buy one of those no load mutual funds. All right. And that's a mutual fund that doesn't pay commissions, right?
Correct.
But what's most people don't realize that even though there's not commissions involved, a lot of times the lack of commissions is made up by higher administrative costs. Isn't that true?
Not necessarily.
Are you able to name a mutual fund company? I don't know if you can do this on. That is a no load, no commissions, all right, and has no administrative fees and gets a real good rate of return.
Well, there are no mutual funds that have zero administrative fees. Okay. Every mutual fund has administrative fees. And it's fees for marketing, it's fees for management. It doesn't mean that you pay no load, simply means you don't pay anything up front to buy the product, right? A lot of these days, a lot of people have been buying index funds or ETFs, which are called exchange traded funds, which are kind of like index funds where they have lower administrative costs. The problem is that those are basically on autopilot. So there is no manager at the helm. And the concern is that if things get volatile in the next couple of years, you're probably going to be subject to more risk versus less because it's on autopilot. And so I'm not sure that's necessarily the best way to do it. As far as administrative costs, you know, there are plenty of great companies out there. I don't know if I'm permitted. Actually, one in your hometown, T. Rowe Price, I believe, is from Maryland.
In Baltimore, and aren't they? I think they're in
Baltimore. I think so, yeah. Yes. And they're great family of funds, and most of them do not have upfront costs. And I won't say that they don't have administrative fees. They do, but they're lower than a lot of other companies. But every fund and even index funds have, and only up until recently, everything has had some level of administrative costs. Recently, a couple index funds from, I think Fidelity recently, we'll give them a plug, recently came out where they, I think, have zero administrative costs. So the only concern, though, is look at it this way, though. Historically, index funds are efficient and people have done well. The caveat is because people know they pay nothing to get in and the cost of entry and exit is so little, human nature kicks in and most people actually, if you look at the history as far as investor performance and those types of products is actually not very good, not because the investments didn't do well, but people were more inclined to go in and go out more frequently because there is no cost of entry or exit. And therefore, the average holding time in some of those products is much less. And therefore, people do far less, not because the product did poorly, but because of their own decisions.
Now, as a CFP, you make money on, I think you told me you do some consultation, right?
Correct.
You charge on an hourly basis. And then,
hourly or annual retainer, yes.
All right. And also, there's a, you charge a fee based on the money balance in the fund at the end of the year. Is that correct?
Correct.
Now, which one do people prefer? One over the other? They don't care. Right. What do you find? Do you have clients? Have you always been a percentage of the account at the end of the year? Have you always used that practice? Or were you at some point getting commissions only from buying and selling?
Well, you have to understand, you know, charging an asset management fee or a percentage of the assets, that's really only come onto the scene for the last 10 to 20 years. So prior to that, that didn't even exist. And most asset managers, you'd have to charge a fee for someone to enter and purchase a fund. Then if you wanted to get out of fund A and go to fund B, if it was in a different fund company, you might have to pay another fee. So that type of business is dried up and has gone away. But it used to be only that type of business. That's just what the industry was, how things were structured. Nowadays, you know, people don't mind paying a percentage on the assets because it's product agnostic. That means that the fee that they pay is, you know, there's no bearing on the product that we choose. So whether we decide to buy a stock or a bond or a mutual fund or preferred stock or an index fund, it doesn't matter. The fee remains constant. And as long as at the end of the year we're trailing or tracking or outperforming the index, or, you know, or slightly trailing it, but at a significantly lower level of risk, clients are happy. And the other thing too is in those types of accounts, certain products like mutual funds very often offer cheaper share classes, or what are called institutional share classes, which means that those administrative fees are less expensive to the client. So even though they may pay me a fee, other expenses are cheaper. So the net to them is probably nominally higher.
What I'm hearing from you is that the average person, if they, you know, first of all, don't nickel and dime yourself. You know, if you're involved with these investments, and we're talking about your retirement, it's so, as you can see, the terminology is complex. All right. When you pay taxes and when you don't pay taxes is complex. So I would recommend to someone this. All right. If you're not an estate attorney, if you're not a broker that buys and sells stocks, all right, don't become one now. All right. Just pay someone to do that. All right. Because the chances are, if you pay them to do it, they'll do a much better job than you will, who have no idea of what you're doing. All right. You know, I take the philosophy of this. If a pipe bursts in my house, I'm not going to try to actually change it. One, I don't know how to do it. And two, I could take my time and better use it than changing that pipe. And I wish people would understand that. You know, this is why we have people in our society doing different things. That's why we have plumbers. That's why we have doctors, dentists. All right. If you have a toothache, are you going to pull your own tooth? Probably not. All right. I'm just thinking about that as I say it. I just made myself completely nauseous. But no, you know, actually, I remember there used to be a show, That's Incredible. Do you remember that? I don't know.
Oh, sure.
All right.
Oh, sure.
And they used to show these crazy things. And they showed this oral surgeon giving himself a root canal. And, you know, he's on the chair and he's got the, you know, the needle up there. And he actually was able to do it, you know. But that's not a good use of your time, okay? I would say do what you do best. If you are an accountant, a CPA, then continue being a CPA. And maybe plumbing, you can hire someone. And in the time that you pay to hire that person to do the plumbing, you could generate more fees in services to your clients. And also, you would keep up the goodwill with your clients. You know, don't be cheap. Penny wise and pound foolish, I think they call it. Do you have people that, Steve, anybody say to you, hey, we don't want to pay any of your fees. We're going to go and try it ourselves. And then they fall on their face and they come back to you. Do you have any of those types of clients? Do you deal with those?
Sure. Yeah. You know, we see that all the time that, you know, people want to, you know, don't want to, you know, you get what you pay for, right? So people want to save money, but they don't realize what's involved. And unfortunately, what happens is when they go out and try to do it themselves, it's not just about putting your energy in where you're good at versus what you're not good at. It's also, you can make a lot of costly mistakes. And the bottom line is that there's another saying, you don't know what you don't know. So, you know, a lot of people might try to go out and do things on their own, and they may not look at things from a tax perspective. They don't understand how to offset gains with losses at the end of the year. They don't understand, you know, the risks involved in certain investments. And what ends up happening is they might save a couple bucks here or there, but it costs them a lot more because they make these other mistakes. And so, you know, I think unfortunately, you know, it's your plumbing, you know, analogy is perfect. I sometimes use the analogy of like, if you're doing a renovation on your house and you want to be the general contractor, you know, it's the point is you're putting yourself in a position in which you have no experience. And if you have no experience, you're probably paying too much for other people to do certain things for you. And you don't know the right timeline to get things done. And there are going to be mistakes made. And those mistakes might cost you more than what you could have paid to have someone who knows what they're doing lead the helm. And I think that's important.
And before I forget, I wanted to state, I am not a compensated endorser of Steve Gross. All right. I'm not getting anything for saying Steve is a terrific financial planner. All right. First of all, I don't know what type of financial planner. I'm assuming he's a real good one. He does well. And that's another thing. All right. I like to deal with people who do well. All right. Because chances are they're doing well. They'll do well with my account. But I go to a financial planner, I have a suit on with holes and it's falling apart. All right. Not to be a snob, I would probably say, wait a minute, if that guy is that poor, all right, I don't want to put my money with that person. All right. They probably didn't do well with their own investments. So, you know, that's another thing. Find someone you are comfortable with. Make sure the clothes are not torn. All right. Steve, is your clothes ever torn? And also look at the bottom of their shoes. All right. Because you never want to deal with a heel. All right. That's my slogan. All right. Actually, I thought that was pretty good. What'd you think?
I think that was good. I like
Thank
that.
You, thank you.
Perfect.
All right. But anyway, Steve, we had discussed this in advance. If they want to get a hold of Steve, who actually, how many years experience do you have in this business, Steve?
Since 93. So you're talking a little over 25 years.
God, you look good for your age, Steve.
You really
good.
Thank you.
You look very good.
Considering I'm only 39, that's pretty good.
Well, yeah, you can lie to the people, but not that much. now, Steve, if you're not allowed to mention your company, correct?
Correct.
All right. But if someone wants to get a hold of you, what can they do to get a hold of Steve Gross and work with him? By the way, do you charge to put together a plan? If you put together a financial plan, is there a charge to the people you deal with?
If somebody wants a simple plan and just wants to have kind of an initial consultation, there is no charge. If someone wants to do some sort of comprehensive financial plan, yes, we do charge. It really depends on, you know, the complexity of their situation, the level of assets that they have. So that could be anywhere from $1,000 to $2,500.
And what's the minimum amount of assets a client that you deal with must have to deal with your company?
As I mentioned to you, we actually don't have a minimum. And the reason is that, one, I have a couple people that work with me who are also advisors. And because of that, we don't have to turn anyone away. And you never know who people know. We're only a referral-based practice. And therefore, that the only way we bring on new clients is through word of mouth. And so generally, our sweet spot is between about $500,000 and $5 million of investable assets. However, I've got lots of people that are starting out, even millennials, and we're happy to see how we can help them.
Terrific. All right. So I'll go back, and I didn't answer the question. I keep asking. They want to get a hold of you, Steve. What should they do? Call Yeager CPA Review?
That's the best way to contact Yeager CPA Review, and then you guys can put them in touch with me. Because of certain compliance regulations and do not solicitation rules that are out there, this is the best way that we can do that from a compliant perspective.
And also, Steve, as I say, Steve, we're not getting paid for referring Steve if we do. What we do these podcasts for are two reasons. One, we try to make it informative, and sometimes it's entertaining. Rob, how would you call this on the entertainment meter? 1 to 10, 10 being the highest.
I'd say about a 3.5, 4.
3.5, okay.
This isn't the most entertaining one we've had, but it's definitely very important.
Yeah, we usually give the guests some alcohol before. And
yeah, that could have been more fun.
Oh, I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
That Irish coffee.
Irish
I could have done a dance or something. I don't know. It's well, people wouldn't see the dance, so that wouldn't help.
Well, I know for a fact Steve does pole dancing. So, you know, it would have been.
Hey, Phil, someone's going past your front door.
Thank you. Thank you very much. every time someone goes past the front door of this house, the chimes go off. God. And by the way, that's a plug for
Phil
ADT.
He's supposed to silence
ADT.
His phone.
Excellent, excellent security system. But. Anyway, you need to get a hold of Steve. You want to talk to him? Hey, he's willing to talk to you, help you. All right. Just call us, send us an email, and we'll put you in touch with Steve. And you're under no obligation, if you talk to Steve, you're under no obligation to buy anything. All right. Just you can listen to him, get some advice. All right. And he is willing to do that. We heard him, and we have a binding agreement to that effect. Right, Steve?
Correct.
Terrific. All right, Steve, thank you so much. We certainly, I'm sure we could have spoken a lot longer, but this is such an involved area. So maybe if you're up to it, we'll have you back another time, all right, because you're just besides the fact that you're a hell of a good-looking guy, and you look like now you can work for the phone company with that headset. Right. We'd like to have you on again. So anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for making Jaeger CPA Review the number one podcast. And we will continue to come up with topics that are of interest to you. And as we say, if you have any topics you want us to talk about, please send us that and Rob will tell you how to do that. And we will see you next time for another Jaeger CPA Review podcast. This is Phil Jaeger. Thank you very much for listening. And thank you, Steve Gross, for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
Go ahead, Rob. Take it away.
Once again, I'd like to thank you for being the best part of CPA Review and more with your host, Phil Jaeger of Jaeger CPA Review. Again, my name's Rob Medford. I'm your producer and director here at CPA Review and More and Jaeger CPA Review. If you have any questions, comments, or topics you'd like to hear about on the podcast, we want to hear from you. Send me an email to podcast@JaegerCPAReview.com. That email will be in the description bar below. If you're in the market for a CPA review course or simply want to know more about the CPA exam, check out JaegerCPAReview.com and you can learn more about our new subscription format. Again, if you're in the market for a CPA review course, Jaeger now offers a month-to-month subscription format of their CPA review product with a no long-term commitment. So you can check it out, take your exams, and then when you're done, simply cancel your subscription or keep it rolling if you want continued access to the course material. For more information about our subscription, check out JaegerCPAReview.com. Until next time, everybody, thank you for listening and take care.